Correctly with the correct amount.
D20 Radio, your gamer's role.
www.d20radio.com.
Roll for initiative.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the RFI podcast, the Roll for Initiative podcast, issue number 14. I'm your host, DM Vincent, along with DM Nick and DM Jason. DM Jason, how was your week in gaming this week?
Hey, so my week, I sort of took a week off because the DM in my other game and one of the main players in my game had a great news this week. He had his first son was born this week.
Oh, cool.
So everybody, welcome. I won't give his last name, but welcome into the world, the new Cassius True.
Congratulations.
Yeah,
great. Congratulations.
Awesome kid.
And of course, as that other voice you can hear in the background, that is DM Nick. DM Nick, how are you this week?
Very good, very good. Good week in gaming, too. I'm looking forward to starting a whole new campaign.
Oh, yeah, a whole new one. Why is that?
Well, it's gotten to the point where it's like I could throw Type 4 demons at my players, and it's like they kill them in two segments. So, like, no challenge anymore.
yeah, I think it's time to do the reboot reset thing.
How high have your players gotten?
They're, like, levels 8 to 10th.
Mm-hmm.
And they're taking them out in two segments?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, my week in gaming was a little postponed due to some family issues, so I'll be resuming next week, hopefully, if my group gets together. So, anyway, let's go on to the website, rfipodcast.com, where we have a bunch of articles posted up by writers. People are contributing left and right. If you want to contribute, rfistaff@gmail.com, and Jason will get in contact with you and talk to you about the article. And Jason, any requirements you want to throw out there before people start emailing? I want to write.
Well, right now, anybody who thinks they have something useful or entertaining to talk about, please, you know, just pitch your ideas. We've got about three new writers that have joined the website staff so far. Mm-hmm. We have a wand or some type of magic item.
Sword.
We have Todd Hughes, who's writing a section called Plus Two to Save, which is a new weekly feature that talks about different things. We're going to talk about one of his articles today. We also have, I don't know his name, I just see PC Buzz.
Yeah, he's Buzz from the D20 Radio forums. He just wants to go by Buzz, he said.
Okay, I like the fact that while some people are DM Vince, he's PC Buzz.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I got it. That was good. He had a really
politically
good
correct
view.
Buzz?
He had a, yeah, player character.
Oh, I'm
actually,
sorry.
Yeah, I want to see somebody write in and be NPC somebody. maybe I'll change my name.
NPC Jason, okay.
Could be. He wrote a great review of some modules that are on the Dragon's Foot forums. And then we also have some new stuff coming in from another writer who I just lost his email, but I know he's going to be putting some things up pretty soon. So if you have ideas, pitch them. We'll give them a listen. And if they sound good, you know, we'll put you on the site.
Yeah, what better way to start your writing career than writing for us, and then the companies out there will see it, and maybe they might just hire you.
Yeah, because we have so much clout right now.
We do. We have tons of clout. Come on.
I know. I'm not being sarcastic at all.
Okay. My apologies.
All right. I can never tell.
Anyway, so you can go there, or you can go to the Dragon's Foot forum and leave us a note there, or the D20 Radio forums, and join their community with their large amount of 20 podcasts going on there right now.
I do want to say that if you are a established writer and you're already pretty good at it, you're very welcome as well. And if the one thing I'll say is, although I do proofread and edit the stuff before it goes up, if you're incredibly bad at English, don't put me through that, please.
I especially encourage all those people to call in, and I'm kidding.
Don't worry, we will promptly put those articles into the trash with the OTUG.
Jeez. Anyway, and you can also look for us on Facebook, our fan page, the Roll for Initiative fan page. We're getting closer. We're halfway to 100, almost there. So join up. Drag all your friends. Make sure they join up. Listen to all the shows. Leave us a voicemail, 90 seconds or less. 206-279-3272. Ha, I remembered it this week.
Uh-huh.
It's not something something like last week.
You've got
that
it
sounds
down,
a lot better.
You?
It yes. sounds better than something something. Yes,
something something dark side. Yeah, much better than that. We want to encourage maybe some bumpers. A lot of the podcasts out there, including the D20 Radio podcast, have bumpers. Wouldn't you like to hear your voice on the beginning of the show? Maybe the beginning of or the end of a show. Maybe hi, this is your name. I'd like to keep it old school with the RFI podcast.
My name?
Yeah, your name. Hi, this is Nick. You can say your Nick if you want.
Sweet.
And that'll wrap up the long introduction again this week. No, not as long as last week. But we will head into the feature of the week.
Feature.
And for the feature this week, we are going to focus on an article that is up on the Roll for Initiative website right now. It's the second in a weekly series called Plus Two to Save. A very good new writer named Todd Hughes. One thing that Todd does, in addition to writing great articles for our site, is he writes adventures and publishes them on Dragon's Foot, makes them available for anybody who wants them. He did a good one that a lot of people have played through called The Disappearance of Harold the Hedgemage. So for this week, he did a article called Creating Your Own Adventure, a nice little set of things to think about when you are getting ready to create your own adventure.
Yay.
Hooray. So I'll run through a quick outline of what he's done here. I encourage everybody to go onto the site, leave him a comment. So, you know, really all of us, whether we're writers on the website or talkers on the podcast, we're doing this out of love, and the way we get paid is in hearing what everybody thinks of it. So leave him a comment, tell him what you think. The article goes into a nice little outline, and it starts with the very idea of having a baseline. So when you get ready to put an adventure together, you're going to need a foundation, something that everything's going to build off of. And as he says here, it's really the hardest part of coming up with an adventure, which is what is going to be that hook. And so he gives you a few different ways to go about that. First one is brainstorming. So just to sit down, get a short sentence that pops into your head and just come up with a whole lot of different things. I mean, maybe you've done brainstorming before with other people. You could do that with other people, or you can even just do it with yourself, just writing down ideas. It's all about quantity, about getting as many things down as you can, and you're going to find something that really hits you.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
The other thing is to just pay attention to the world around you. You know, listen to an offhand remark from other people or something that's being posted on the forums. One person mentioned, actually it was me. He says it in here. Jason mentioned something about shouldn't there be a module where the main bad guy is a doppelganger? Hey, there's your hook. The bad guy is a doppelganger. Go from there. He also talks about skimming, just kind of skimming through other books, other modules, anything like that. And in the example that he gives in the article, he goes and selects a creature from the Fiend Folio, which Todd happens to be a big fan of, the Fiend Folio, I mean, and he picks the Blindheim, little frog creature with the spotlights for eyes that, I don't know, they do something. I think they blind you.
Yeah, I remember that one. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then right away he goes into the next step after you get your idea, and that is think of how it's going to end. Think of the end game. So just like being a good author, you want to know where you're going with all of this. So figure out what's going to be the moment that it all comes together, what's going to be the denouement, or however you pronounce that. Then he goes into how to write a hook. And the hook can be anything. It can be something as straightforward as you're there for looting and killing stuff, which is a perfectly acceptable motive in AD&D. You may want to push your characters towards fame and fortune. one that's really good here he calls the goody two-shoes. Sometimes you have a player who's decided that his whole motivation is doing good, so it's very easy to hook them in. And he's talking about these not in the sense of you're trying to push this on your players. You're looking for what your players really respond to.
Okay.
You know, so whoever you have in your campaign, you know what your players are like. You know what's really going to get them. You know whether just saying there's a huge treasure under that hill guarded by a dragon is going to be enough, or whether there's going to be some way that you can appeal to their inner nature, appeal to their fame and fortune. Just figure out basically what's in it for me. What's going to be the thing that really gets your players excited about it?
What's my motivation?
Oh, geez.
Exactly. But that's exactly what it is, because your players are the actors in your little drama. So if you're really going to get them going, you have to speak to their own motivations, their own characters. This is what can be so good about writing your own adventure rather than just pulling one off the shelf. I mean, Vince, I think, you know, you are a big one for writing your own adventures.
Well, yeah, I have my own little list. I call it the list, but I won't be the first person to call it the list. But want me to go over how I do my planning and step phases?
Sure, yeah.
Well, first, usually what I do is I take a little, what do they call those, notepads? The little ones you used to write your assignments on for school back in the day when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
I carry that around with me for about a week, and I jot down little ideas here and there because, you know, you get an idea, and you think about it, and you're like, oh, that'd be cool to use in my adventure, and an hour later you forgot.
Yeah.
So just jot it down. Even if it sounds, you know, cool, and then like an hour later it sounds stupid, you can always cross it out. I do that, and I fill up a couple little pages in my notebook, and then I go home each day, and I write inside of a spiral notebook ideas on how to hook the adventure, what ways to get the players interested in it, what's their motivation, like Nick said.
Yes.
And then what I would do next is then I would throw my ideas out on the web, like go to different forums and talk about it and see what other people think about it and see what they can do. Maybe they'll build upon it, and I'll take their ideas that they built upon and use it for my adventure. Then I would plan out some of the major NPCs that I'd be using in there and what creatures I'd like to use. Not necessarily, if I don't use them all, I don't, but at least I have them on a piece of paper and planned out so I don't have to flip through the book. And then I'll draw my maps that I want to use. If I want to use a dungeon, if I want to use a castle, if I want to use a tavern, I have all the stuff drawn out ready to use. If I don't use it 1 week, I have it for the next week. Then I write out my major segments that I want, or like battles that I want. If I want a big battle to happen over the, let's say, the giant diamond, I'll write it out how I want the players to get into that thing. Not necessarily knowing they're going to walk into it that way, but at least I have an idea and I can always lead them into it another way.
Mm.
So that's how I pretty much write all my adventures.
So how about the end game, like Todd talks about?
End game? I mean,
you know, the moment, what's going to be the big climax to the adventure? How do you know when you've completed everything?
When I'm happy with the end result.
Right. Yeah, so part of the idea is to figure, is there going to be a specific goal that the characters have to achieve to get through this adventure, or is this a dungeon crawl that just has things available?
Mine actually does. The one I was running did have a goal. It's on hiatus right now. It's called The Crown and the Ring.
Mm-hmm.
I actually took the idea from Manowar. The group.
What's that?
It's
the band?
Yeah, the band from the 80s, Manowar. They had a Crown and the Ring. I believe it was called. It was a song, The Crown and the Ring, or was it an album? I don't remember. And I stole the idea from that.
That's really, you know, that's a really good place to get ideas for adventures. It's 80s
music,
metal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, big time.
Sweet, I like that.
Nick, the circle comes complete.
That's true. Nick, what do you do for your games?
Well, you know, because of my time constraints in the past,
right?
I still do this now. I tend to scavenge kind of ideas. I'll be honest, I primarily use pre-published modules, but I try to make them my own in as much as I might scavenge pieces here and there from different adventures or little scenarios that have been written, and I'll try to incorporate some of my own ideas into that. To give an example of that, when I was running the Saltmarsh series, and I think I alluded to this when I did the Blackstone's Vault segment, what I did to make the town is I used another module, L1, Secret or Bone Hill, which has that whole town in there of Rentonsford, I think it's called. And I expanded upon it. I added a lot more buildings, added some more NPCs, changed little things here and there, but the basics of it was there. There was a basic map. There was some RENPCs fleshed out. But I added a little bit of my own to it and kind of made it my own particular adventure. So I always tinker with adventures. I'm never 100% fully satisfied with a module with some things. I'll like change things here and there. But yeah, I kind of use those as a framework and I'll fiddle around with it. That's how I kind of do things. I've written a couple of things of my own, but I think I'm not too confident in my own writing, I guess, of writing my own adventures. But I think I'm going to start venturing into that a little more and just see how it goes.
Yeah, one thing I've never really been big on is writing modules in the classic format, the way that it would be written if you were going to publish it for other people.
Oh. Yeah.
I mean, I really enjoy making campaigns. That's kind of everybody I think has a different thing that gives them fun when it comes to the creation side of DMing. And for me, it's making those big maps of entire worlds and, you know, thinking about the countries mm-hmm. and the histories between them. So the adventures that happen in those places, for me, I kind of mix it up between pre-published modules, finding a way to maybe alter them a little bit to fit my campaign setting, and then occasionally putting things of my own into them that I've got them sketched out. I know what's going to happen. I know what's there, but I don't necessarily have the rooms plotted out in the, you know, properly structured way. So nobody else would really be able to pick one of mine up and run it, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, the classic style is not easy to adapt to when writing up something for publishing material. I know from speaking from some experience and writing some stuff up and handing it into various places and having it rejected, obviously, because I didn't have the right format. But, you know, you learn. That's how you learn. So.
Right.
Well, you know, there was an interesting when you're writing these things, the issue comes down also to the difference between writing for a gameplay adventure and writing, you know, fantasy fiction, so to speak. Because if when you start writing these things, it's really easy to get into the mode where you're actually just writing the story and you're deciding how everything's going to turn out. And that doesn't really make for good gameplay. Then you've got the players on rails, as they say.
That's true.
Yeah. No, we don't want to railroad anybody. I that's my number one rule. I hate doing that, is railroading people in my campaigns. They'll get to it when they get to it, pretty much, is what I say. And you always have a reason to get around it. I mean, if you don't use segment A at a certain time, you can always lead that twist in the road they pick into the room you want, so...
And I think a lot of DMs start that way with creating a railroad adventure and maybe a railroading kind of campaign, because probably that's what we're kind of comfortable with before we get in a little more free form, a little bit more of a sandbox type situation. You know, it's kind of a comfort zone, I think, for some people. I know I started that way. I know I started to be a much more railroad type than maybe like you or Jason are. But I've gotten a little more confident in my DMing abilities, and I found that actually being a little bit less structured has found it more enjoyable for my players and for myself as a DM. But I mean, I like to have like a basic plot or maybe something like that. Maybe something, some other things already created. But
right,
yeah.
I think it'll. That's where. Go ahead, Jason. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say, Nick. I think that's where the Call of Cthulhu stuff can be really helpful because it's so unstructured. If you play that as well, that when you play that enough, you can kind of carry over some of that loose, free form, do anything you want in the world approach to the gaming that you're doing with AD&D.
I also did notice something. Well, a lot of players. It all depends on how you started playing too. Like
true.
When I told you I started playing, Jason, we spoke about the great Joe DM,
mm-hmm.
and he was a very free-form DM. He never used a module; everything was off the top of his head, and he remembered everything from time to time. So that's how I learned to get my. He showed me how to do things, and that's how I learned it. Nick, when you first started playing, did your group use modules? And
oh my gosh.
If you remember back that far,
way back in the way long time ago.
Junior.
Yes, back in 1980, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I would say, we were kids. We didn't know what the heck we were doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember going over my friend Thad's house and...
go ahead.
And...
so you're going over your friend's
house? And, and we would have the... we had the module Against the Giants out there, and I think we even just had the map laid out, and we all, played it out right there,
Saw the whole map, and everything was right in front of you.
Yeah, we had no idea what we were doing. So,
sure.
But over time, as you learn, and I think one of the big things, I went to a convention not too mm-hmm. long after that. And I think that was a huge influence on how not to DM and to play.
And one of the things I'm sorry. Sorry.
No, I was just saying I was very observant in that when I went to my first convention and saw how other people played. I remember taking that to heart.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to step on you there. But one of the things that really helped me when I first went to a convention, and I think it might even be the same one you went to, it was Omicron in Omaha.
Yeah.
Sitting at a game with somebody who was a very experienced DM who had been doing it a lot, and I was expecting them to just have it down perfect, and seeing that they had to fudge things occasionally and that they were not sitting there, with everything at their fingertips, and it just made me feel like it was okay to wing it a little bit.
Hmm. Right.
I learned a lot of DMing on the fly from, remember the PC game, and that's not player character, that's personal computer, game Neverwinter Nights that came out, I don't know, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
They actually had a big community, and there was a whole thing with a DM side to the game, and they had DM 101, so I said, what the heck? I'll give it a shot. And they actually had some really good tips in there on how to DM and impromptu things in the game, so that also gave me a little push up into how to DM really well.
That's cool. And you take all those things into consideration, it gives you not only confidence as a DM when you're playing in front of your people, it gives you better confidence when we turn on and we talk about creating our adventures too, what we feel like we can and cannot do. And so, yeah, I think that all ties in together when creating those adventures for our players.
Yeah, so when you sit down and you're getting ready to write your adventure, you're going to be coming at it with a lot of things that are probably, wouldn't it be amazing if this happened or that happened? And, be prepared for a little bit of disappointment if your players are just wandering off the map, literally and figuratively, because it's okay, and that's what's going to give them the most fun. You know the look that you get on a player's face when they feel they're being railroaded. You can just see the fun kind of draining out of them. So the most important thing is to put together the things that are available, know what's going to be in that world, but don't feel like you're failing if they didn't follow the path that you thought they were going to follow.
Oh, yeah, of course. I tell any person that starts DMing for the first time, if your players don't do exactly what you wrote and you want them to do it, there's always a way to throw it in somehow, somewhere. There's always an
opening. Oh, yeah.
People don't seem to get that.
The player or the NPC that was going to be you know, hiding in the closet in one room, fine, he's in a different room.
Jason, or the encounter where you created with, like, oh, I don't know what happened to me last time. I created an encounter with, like, three ropers. They never even went in that part of the dungeon.
I know,
I was looking forward to that, and I'm like, oh, well.
A perfect example of a new person that was actually GMing, we'll say, for a different game. I was listening to another podcast, and they had to explain this. The person had written out a whole adventure where they had everything, and the big bad guy was in room 7. And the players figured out a way to get to that room quicker than he wanted to, so he would not let the players into that room. And his reasoning behind that was, well, the big boss is in there. I don't want him to get to it again. That'll ruin the campaign. So what advice do we have for that player? Just move the boss to another room.
Yeah, they can't see your map. They don't know.
Yeah, really.
Exactly.
But you know what? That leads to a really good point. You know, beyond just writing the module, while you're playing it, it's incredibly important as a DM to have a way to keep notes about what's going on so that you don't forget that you moved the big boss to another room. You don't forget that the player left their torch in the hallway or whatever happened.
Exactly.
Right.
It was one of the toughest things for me to learn to do, and it still is one of the toughest things for me to remember to do, you know, whether it's keeping track of time or who dropped what where or what you know, if you forgot that there was going to be a trap somewhere, whatever the thing is. I mean, I've started relying on index cards or actually I'm trying out post-it notes now, which are kind of useful for me. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. What do you guys do?
I jot down notes in a notebook. I have my journal notebook for the adventure always open and ready to go. To write down ideas.
Yeah, see, I'm always losing my place in the notebook.
Yeah, you know, I usually have my laptop there.
Yeah.
And I'll...
What's that?
That wooden thing that you remember you talked about the last time?
Oh, the wooden, that wooden thing with the, yeah. That you said on
the electronic abacus. But I'll either, like, put some notes down there in a Word document, or I'll have some sheets out there already, like, printed out. And if something unusual happens, yeah, I'll make a note in there along the side somewhere on another page, and hopefully I'll remember it from the next time. But, yeah.
Well, this is probably for a future show, but I was thinking a little bit about this. I went ahead and picked up an iPad when they came out, and it's a different situation than a laptop because you're not hiding behind it and it doesn't really draw your attention. And there are some apps on the iPad that are meant for note-taking that could be very good for this kind of thing. So I may try that out and report back later.
Yeah, we'd like to hear about how the iPad is. Did you buy the upgraded one with the big, large space and everything?
I just got the middle one. Yeah, I think that's what most people probably did.
Okay, cool. Well, maybe another show in the beginning. You can talk a little bit about it if you've test run it through one of your adventures, maybe at the gaming table.
Once we've given it a try.
Yeah. I think that'll wrap up the feature this week of Create Your Own Adventure. If you want to write us and tell us how you do it, your steps, and we'll talk about it in our next show, rfistaff@gmail.com. And that'll throw us into the Creature Feature Theater.
Creature, feature, theater, theater, theater. This week on Creature, Feature, Theater, we are going to look at and talk about gnolls.
Gnolls.
And, or gnolls.
I knew that was going to come up.
Come on, Jason.
I knew it. I was like, the one thing we couldn't possibly mispronounce.
Gnolls. So,
I don't know if I want to look at gnolls. They're kind of scruffy looking. But.
This actually came in as a request from on the Facebook fan page from Reese. He wanted us to tackle
Reese on
gnolls.
Facebook.
He wanted us to tackle the gnolls and how we use them. But go ahead, Nick.
Yeah. Good old Reese there on Facebook. I think our first idea coming from Facebook there. And looking at gnolls, Oregon gnolls, out of the Monster Manual, page 46, I was thinking about these creatures, and we have all these multitudes of different humanoids, like goblins, hobgoblins, orcs, and gnolls, and I think gnolls are probably, not a very widely used humanoid race to use against players. I mean, they're there, but I think orcs and goblins and hobgoblins tend to get the lion's share of the attention when being used in adventures.
Mm. Maybe.
I guess it all depends where they're from.
Sorry, Jason.
No, I was just going to say, you want to start with what a knoll is and where this idea of a knoll came from.
I'm not sure where the idea of the knoll came from, but they are one of the, I guess they would be considered a goblinoid type race.
They look like hyenas.
Yes, they're kind of like a hyenaoid kind of.
Well, I know they were originally, goblin type race, which makes sense. You know, it's kind of like a hobgoblin, but I think they were originally supposed to be a cross between like a gnome and a troll.
Really?
Which is what always kind of threw me off at first, because when I hear the word gnoll, it sounds more like gnome to me. So I think of gnolls and I think of tiny little things, but then I got to remember they're 7 feet tall.
Yeah.
Where'd you hear that from?
It was, it was the first OD&D. It was something that Gary Gygax wrote in OD&D, that they were a cross between gnomes and trolls.
I did not know that. That is weird, wild stuff.
Well, thank you very much, Johnny.
you learn something new every day. Wow.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I was going through the monster manual on this, reading about this creature, some things really intrigued me about the gnoll. It talks about how, you know, they're arranged in clans or packs, but there's also a king of the gnolls. And I thought that would be a really cool adventure hook, maybe, to look for a king of the gnolls. So just kind of throwing that out there. Also, the gnolls themselves seem to have some pretty heavy-duty allies. They like to use trolls from time to time as guards, which can be quite a challenge for players, and also using hyenas and hyenodons as comparable to orcs when they are using like direwolves or what have you. So I thought this whole combination with these gnolls and trolls, hyenas and hyenodons would make a really interesting kind of lair setup. And looking up the stuff on, well, just looking up stuff on trolls, just to refresh my memory on things, you know, trolls are nasty in themselves because of regeneration, and hyenas and hyenodons could make some pretty nasty, I don't know if we want to call them cannon fodder, but, you know, shock troops. The hyenodons, particularly nasty.
Yeah, it's interesting to think of the gnolls, if you think of them as being somehow related to the trolls, if you wanted to go down that path, it would make a lot of sense for the trolls to be with them.
Right.
It'd be interesting also to look at a gnoll. Okay, so let's say you've got an aquatic troll. Could there be an aquatic gnoll?
Possibly,
an aquatic anything. So.
Yeah, if you wanted to go down that route, can't see why you couldn't. More on the gnoll that I saw in the monster manual is, you know, they have a lot of the humanoid creatures have listings of different type of weapons that are available to them. The percentage, you know, they talk about the great bow, and that one kind of, I'm like, okay, great bow. What is the great bow damage? It's not listed, so I don't know what I would use for that. I'd probably just, you know, jot some stats down for that.
Mm-hmm.
But they have the possibility of using the great bow along with pole arms, two-handed swords, battle axe, morning star. So a pretty good list of very nasty weapons that they can use. So kind of going along with this, with the gnolls and the other humanoid creatures that they kind of go along with, I looked up in the DMG under the humanoid racial preference table chart, and that's on page 106.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And when maybe using these with other creatures, because, you know, I that's one something I like to do. I like to kind of mix it up a little from time to time. And looking up these creatures, I thought it was very interesting. Mm-hmm. And in their relation, say, for to bugbears and ogres, they do tolerate each other, but from they will,
yes,
they might harass each other from time to time. And I kind of took that as like something that where they all, you know, like practical jokes that might play on each other, drinking games, gambling, you know.
So, drinking games and practical jokes. That's an interesting approach to it.
Well,
so that's how I kind of took it. It's like, you know, they're sure, tolerate each other, but, you know, they might, you know, rib each other from time to time if these two races, bugbears and ogres, along with gnolls, are together. So almost, I'm thinking of like humanoid frat party almost.
I'm starting to get a picture of, as you're talking about this, I'm getting a picture of gnolls in my mind as sort of similar to half-orcs, in the sense that you've got two humanoid races that, whether or not they're actually literally supposed to be they're not actually supposed to be the product of the offspring of a gnome and a troll, although I don't want to think about how that works, but they're, yeah, if there's nonetheless, if they're somehow related to this, and their intelligence is low to average? Yeah, low to average.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're going to be maybe a little bit smarter than the troll, a little bit dumber than the gnome. I don't think they're going to be anything that you have to play up their stupidity too much, but I can definitely see them being more like a biker gang than anything else.
Well, I'm gonna have to,
oh, yeah, I agree.
Hold on, guys. I'm going to interrupt you. So why do these creatures have to be stupid, first of all?
Well, because it says low to average intelligence.
Okay, well, it's my campaign. I can do whatever I want. So let me give you a perfect example of how I've used gnolls in the past, which moves us on to our next talking point here. How do you use them? I had written out a scenario that for my players, because I know my players really well, that they were walking through the forest trying to find this cabin that I had and therefore directed them to. So what I did was the gnolls were hiding in the bushes surrounding the area. I had them tie a bag on a rope from a limb branch and just let it swing there. Okay. I wanted to see how dumb the players were going to be. So, obviously, we have the players that agree they're going to sneak up to it, and there's going to be the fighter who's going to be searching around looking for the gnolls. Well, the gnolls that are hiding in the bushes, or when the players get near the bag and find out there's nothing but rotting meat in it, are going to throw rocks over their heads into the other side of the forest to create this noise, which in turn will get the two fighter-type characters to start charging in that general direction, thinking there's a threat to jump out to them. So what the gnolls will do now is jump out from behind, attacking the magic user and the healer who are just standing there going, what's going on? So why can't you use that type of strategy?
You totally could. I mean, I don't think that's going contrary to being of average intelligence.
No, but everyone always assumes that like it's a goblin or it's a gnoll. They just come straight out and attack everybody. No, you can.
Oh, no, they'll use strategy. Of course they would. Yeah.
I think that's a really good strategy. I think it says something really interesting about if your players actually went for all that, do you have to readjust their intelligence scores?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That may be so.
Well, if you're playing during that time period, if it was real life, and you were running around in the forest and things are attacking you left to right, and you start hearing bushes move from your right, you're going to pretty much be jumpy, and you're going to jump towards that. So,
right.
Maybe. Clearly they were.
Well, how would you use them, Jason, then?
How would I what?
How would you use your gnolls?
Well, I don't know. Listening to what Gnick was saying...
I have plenty more.
I haven't put gnolls in a campaign before because, like I said, when I looked at gnolls, I had a hard time really grasping what they were supposed to be like. You know, what's their culture and history and background, and why would I bring gnolls into a campaign rather than orcs or trolls?
I always pictured gnolls as they are some sort of canine humanoid creature, and they are going to have some sort of canine qualities. You know, they're going to have some canine attributes to them. So I've always played them in that sort of way. Because also with their association with hyenas and the hyena dons, which are not they're pretty much carrion eaters. I almost keep I play gnolls in that sense from time to time as well, that they'll eat carrion from as well. But
I don't know what a hyaenodon is.
It's a basically it's the Pleistocene version of a hyena. It's a big much bigger version of a hyena. It's the prehistoric hyena, basically.
Is that in one of the books?
Yeah, it's in the Monster Manual, page 54.
Really?
It'd be like the size of a dire wolf or something, right?
It's got some very good stats, in fact. If I look it up here.
Oh, it's a single line.
It's hard. It's easy to miss.
Hyenas are simply huge. Hyaenodons are huge hyenas. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, but they're nasty. I mean, 5 hit dice, damage attack 3 to 12. So they're large creatures. Yep. Pretty nasty little buggers.
So yeah, I think gnolls for me, they don't hold a lot of appeal to me in a campaign because I can't really. Maybe at some point if I start thinking a little bit more about how they actually live and how they do these things, but they don't hold a lot of appeal to me, honestly, because they seem to be more of just tough creatures to come up against, good fighters.
Well, but not necessarily. I have more.
Dan,
oh yes, I do.
Go on, Nick. Go on.
Well, in relation to other creatures on humanoids, the racial types. Table. Goblins, they look with antipathy. They will fight goblins from time to time unless strong leaders are present. Hill giants, they look at goodwill towards hill giants, and which kind of made me think, maybe if trolls aren't available to use as guards, maybe a hill giant or two? Possibly. Mm-hmm. That might be a good idea. Here's where it gets interesting. Kobolds, they hate each other. Kobolds, gnolls do not get along. And I look at this as kobolds, because they're short and gnolls are tall, they're picking on the little runt guys, basically.
Yeah.
So okay.
I kind of look at them in that way. So, just like, hey, you little squirt, kick them down.
It could be kind of cool to get the players into the middle of a fight between them.
Also, you look at the picture of the gnoll, and you look at a picture of kobold. They look both very similar, do they not?
Let me look.
Yeah, they're very similar looking.
You're right.
Yeah.
So
they're
there
drawn
could be,
similarly.
So maybe hyenas are the gnolls are like the big dogs, and the kobolds are kind of like the chihuahuas to them.
Kobolds are going to be attacking them a lot more.
They're going to be attacking each other a lot more.
I'd love it if the kobolds, if you played them then as the little dogs, so to speak, the ones that have
something
all the time.
That's how I would play it. The little yippy dog against the big, St. Bernard or golden retriever type, As far as hobgoblins, orcs, and trolls, they're neutral towards them. They don't care either way as far as those races are concerned. Now, a little interesting thing about the gnoll is that there is kind of a sub-race associated with them. You remember which one that is?
A semi-gnoll?
No. But a good guess. Jason?
I have no idea. What's the sub-race attached to a gnoll?
The Flind.
Oh, that's right.
Who?
Yeah, that's
the Flind. Right. The Fiend Folio.
Yeah, that's right.
But the problem is with the Flind is basically a more intelligent, shorter, and more, I guess you would say, charismatic form of gnoll. In fact, their alignment is different. The gnolls are chaotic evil. Flinds are lawful evil. And when Flinds are encountered with gnolls, they tend to be the leaders, and gnolls look upon them with much awe and respect. Now, the Flinds, though, they're a little bit weird in the respect that between when the Fiend Folio was written with this particular monster and the gnoll, some things don't jive. In the Flind section in the Fiend Folio, which is on page 39, they say 25% of the time Flinds use clubs, which to me doesn't make sense because I'm like, well, you know, gnolls use pole axes and great bows and what have you. Why would Flints just use, you know, a club? I would use the. I personally would have them have the same chance of using the same weapons as regular gnolls do. Yeah, and I would change one thing about the about their weapons is I would replace the pole arm option with what their special weapon is called, the flind bar. And this flind bar has a chance when they use it. It sounds basically like a pair of nunchucks. And they have a chance when you get your weapon gets hit by a flind bar, there you have to make a save versus wands or they will disarm you. So that's a very interesting weapon that they use as well.
Well, yeah, I really didn't. I forgot totally about this this monster until you actually had brought it up. I remember using it in the past in various games, and actually Joe using it quite a bit in his games. So,
yeah,
good call and remembering that, dude.
Yeah, I thought I've used the combination of the flints and the gnolls together. The only thing other thing about the flint is they do not get along with trolls. They won't work with them, which is contradictory to the gnolls, which like to use trolls. So what do you do? Well, if you have flints that are leading, how I would at least play them is if they are available, if the flints are there, like part of, head of a clan or a lair or what have you, I would maybe substitute hill giants or ogres for trolls that would fill in sort of the same role as the trolls would. Otherwise, overall, I think they're a really cool race to play for your mid-level player characters. So, you know, and I've used them in that respect. How about you, Vince? How about you using the gnolls?
I've used them for around the same level, around maybe third, fourth level, but I had a lot of fun with that scenario. I like writing little scenarios up like that with little monsters that people forget how to use them instead of just, like, running in and whatever. I'd rather use things to make more interesting and get a little role-play aspect out of it. And it just makes it more fun that way than just having them run in. I don't know. I guess 4th edition, the name, you know, the edition we shall not name.
But you did anyway.
I know, I did name it. They did a lot of that with a lot of all the monsters in the Monster Manual, I noticed. And it's a good feature to just pick up the book while you're at the bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And don't buy it, of course. No, well, you know, buy it to support the writers, but look through it and just look at some of the strategies they use for the monsters. I mean, some of them say they'll chuck spears. Some of them say they'll hide in the shadows. I mean, if you just want to get a general idea, because a lot of GMs out there don't know how to run certain monsters, and they just think that, okay, boom, it's a video game. Monster A appears here. Monster B appears here. Fight.
Yeah. And like I was saying, just looking at the gnolls and seeing how they are physically, I always had this concept of canines, of dogs, and I play them similar to how, you know, I have a couple of dogs of my own. I play them similarly like how they would if they were able to, you know, have, you know, weapons and be able to talk, you know?
Your dogs can talk and have weapons?
Not necessarily, but if my dogs did.
All right, I think that'll wrap up the gnolls for this week. We thank you for the suggestion. Anyone else has suggestions, you can drop by Facebook, just drop a plant there, and we'll water it for you. And that's going to put us into our next segment coming up next for playing tips.
Do you have any idea what you're talking about?
Why do I sound like I do?
Playing tips.
So this week in playing tips, we have a wonderful, we're going to talk about the thief class and how to play it properly. Well, not how to play it properly, but how to play it better than the average person. So what can we say about a thief? Well, most of the time they act as a scout. They act as your lock picker, your locksmith. They act as the person that listens at the door because they have a better percent chance to listen around. They have the ability to gather information better for you. They have the ability to hide in shadows. They have the ability to pick pockets. there's always various things you can. They're the person that opens that treasure chest for the first time because they're the ones that can pick the locks and detect if there's traps on the things. So when you play a thief, thief is just more than just the person wearing leather armor running around backstabbing. They actually have a lot of. They have a role play aspect to them, Nick. Did you ever think about that when you make up a thief character?
Oh yeah, absolutely. When looking at it, I guess from a player standpoint, I think when I the couple of times when I used a thief, and unfortunately they've died, but when they were alive,
nice.
I always saw that my character would shine when he was in a town city environment because of those aspects where he can be a spy.
Yeah.
And also his contacts within a particular, you know, city, if it's large enough. I've always kind of played him as, you know, as he's a kind of a criminal type character, and he's going to try to, you know, make the, get the best, try to find the best deal to get whatever gold he can, and, you know, try to make more contacts. Dig up information on people to use for blackmailing. So if you're talking like a role-playing aspect, you know, not only is it just trying to find, information on where you can find things, but also information about people, you know, digging up dirt on certain political figures or spiritual figures within in a city or a town or what have you, and you can use that as leverage against them maybe. So, yeah, that's a really cool role-playing opportunity as I see them in towns and cities.
Yeah, I think when I think of the thief, I don't automatically think of the thief as a thief, literally. I don't necessarily think of them as somebody whose motivation is entirely about stealing things. I really kind of look more at the total number of things they can do and add that up to whatever the kind of person they might be. When I looked looking back at some of the old Dragon magazines before this issue of Roll for Initiative, knowing we were going to talk about the thief, I read a couple of good ones. Back in Dragon 47, Len Lekofka wrote a Leoman's Tiny Hut all about the thief. And then also in Dragon 104, they did a whole series of articles about the thief in one place, so they had the well-rounded thief.
Oh, I recall that one.
Something that was really good in Len Lekofka's is he laid out a real interesting kind of way to look at it from a role-playing perspective. He said, think about five different motivations for why someone is a thief. And he laid them out as greed, professional, revenge, artistic, and recreational. So if you which is really good. So if you think about greed, there's your kind of classic thief. This is somebody who steals things. If you think about it, the professional, somebody who's going to be of lawful alignment, possibly lawful evil, lawful neutral. You're not going to get a lawful good thief.
Why not?
Actually, that's it's worth asking, actually, since, lawful good isn't any more good than chaotic good. But the reason being that if you're combining both the idea of being lawful, meaning, you know, you're going to follow all the laws that, fit your ethos, and being good, meaning that you're going to consider the good laws the ones you have to follow, you put those two things together, and it makes it much more difficult to start engaging in some of the activities. But nonetheless, so professional thief, think of this as somebody who's lawful evil and belongs to a guild, takes assignments, you know, does this for a living, really. So getting closer to your idea of the spy. Revenge, so you have somebody who's avenging something, and they're doing it through the abilities that can be learned by being a thief. And you'll see a lot of these if you go back and you read the Thieves' World stories that we talked about last week with Jeff Grubb. The Avenger isn't necessarily going to be worried so much about gathering treasure and building things up. They're more going to be trying to just take whatever means they can to get that vengeance they're looking for.
Sure, that makes sense.
The ones that I really liked, though, were the last two. Artistic and recreational.
Mm.
Because for these, I think of a noble-born or a very highly-born aristocratic type who maybe that's what they do, maybe even with some of their friends at the club. You know,
Or they're leading a double life.
Yeah, sort of a Batman kind of life, right?
Yeah.
Or you know, the revenge one actually could even be sort of a Robin Hood type. I mean, sure. People usually think of Robin Hood as a ranger, but try thinking about Robin Hood as a thief. So for the artistic or the recreational, and he goes into some good things in this article because he talks about how that might influence what you're actually going to do. So, for example, an artistic thief may take a lot of pride in his or her ability to pick that lock in a certain way, to climb that wall, and just would disdain the idea of ever using magic because it's like cheating. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, maybe the recreational thief doesn't really care how much they're keeping in terms of the loot, the bounty that they get.
Oh. I can almost think of one other. I can think of one other one, too.
Yeah?
When on that list. I'm not sure if it's one in itself or I'll fit into another one, but I was thinking desperation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they are put in a situation to where they have no other choice but to steal and be a thief.
Right. So maybe they grew up
like
as
maybe
a...
they, you know, like maybe they somehow they accrued a enormous debt, mm-hmm. and they have to pay it off. You know, kind of the whole you know Han Solo Jabba the Hutt kind of thing.
You know? Yes.
So
or,
maybe
or
this
grew up on the streets.
No right.
A street urchin.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one if you like Robert Asprin, you know, back to Robert Asprin, but this for his comedy novels, for the Myth Adventures, where Skeeve, at the very, very first book, before he became a wizard, he was actually a thief. And that's how he became a wizard, because one of the wizards that he was trying to steal from caught him.
Yep, I remember that.
But what's kind of cool is if you take those five or six motivations and then jump forward in time in the Dragon magazines to issue number 104, and there was a really good article called Race is Ahead of Class, where the author talks about different – because the thief is the one of the only classes that's really available to every race. So,
yeah, that's true.
So he's like, well, how is a dwarven thief different, for example, from a halfling thief or from an elf or a half-orc? And in this, you know, he lays out the idea of dwarves not really – the dwarven thief not necessarily being so much about the greed and the stealing as it is about being a craftsman and a locksmith and somebody who's acquired these skills because it's his craft. Versus, say, the half-orc who's just an armed robber.
Right.
Or the halflings or the gnomes who are just, you know, very carefree and fun-loving, and possessions don't mean that much to them anyway, and it's just kind of...
They're doing it for the kicks.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact...
For the kicks, man!
I never really thought about it until I read that article, but the idea that halflings aren't necessarily all that into possessions and will often just say, treasure, schmeasure, and just toss it aside. The fun was in getting it, not in keeping it. Did I lose you guys?
No.
No.
We were listening. I heard silence.
We were listening to your point.
Yeah.
We were just totally enamored by what you had to say.
The force of my point just built silence.
Yes.
But let's talk about some of the abilities. The thief. Because, you know, okay, so there's your motivations. There's why you're a thief and how you're going to play them. And as long as we've made the point here that when you're playing a thief, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are a person who burgles and robs and thieves, etc. That may simply be the things that you can do. So what are some of the things that you can do, and how do you do them? Start with the one that people think of the most, and I think, Vince, you said it first, which is opening locks.
Yes, you're a locksmith. Now, where are you leading with this? You want to describe how we would use the skill inside of a game as role-playing-wise?
Well, you know, there's different ways that a DM can bring it up. So you could either say, just roll an ability check, the lock is opened, or, you know, could just try to describe it a little bit like you might with a trap. Personally, I, with a lock, would usually just say, it's a lock, roll to see if you can, to get that lock open. Although in some cases you might want to throw a little extra difficulty into it, and you know, depending on how you play your campaign and how much you get into, you could see if the thief has certain knowledge of some types rather than others.
I never trust my DM, so I usually role play most of the things out. Like I would say, my thief pulls out his pick tools, stands to the side of the door while he's mm-hmm. picking the lock, just in case the door bursts into flames and things like that.
Or in case it's one of the traps from Grimtooths.
Yeah.
There's a really good one in there that when your thief goes up to try to pick the lock, he finds out that it's actually incredibly easy to pick. He gets it with no trouble at all. The trouble is when he actually pulls the doorknob, that it turns out that wasn't a doorknob at all. That was a plug for some poison gas.
I remember that one. Yep, I got that Grimtooths as well.
Yeah. how about finding and removing traps, though?
Well, I think
that's a big one.
On finding and removing traps, you almost have to play it the same way as picking locks. I know when I play a thief, I'm saying, okay, this is how I'm approaching the chest.
Yeah.
I found, and I'm looking around the outside, and I'm looking at the seams of the chest, and so there's kind of a role playing aspect, and then you make the ability roll.
Plus, it gives your DM a chance to actually describe some of the things that you're seeing, because not all traps are the same.
Exactly. And that's as what I do as a DM. I'll describe, like, okay, there's three iron boxes here, and it appears that the locks are built into the chests. And they seem to be a fairly sturdy, solid construction. What do you do then?
So, you know, I think all this kind of leads up to one of the things about DMing for when you have a thief in the party is it really drives home how important it is as a DM to keep talking about everything that's around. Because if mm-hmm. For example, let's say you're in town and the thief is walking around and all of a sudden you say, somebody bumps into you and it's a drunk and he wanders off. And if nothing else has been described, it's pretty obvious that you just got pickpocketed. You know, you've really got to remember that you've got to, as a DM, describe the mundane stuff as well as the unusual things so you don't give anything away to the players.
Right. I agree.
Well, I don't know about that. Maybe you said the mundane stuff, like someone bumps into you, things like... Maybe there'd be a better way to describe that, or maybe you can make a hidden role or something, because if you say... Well, at least I know what my players, if I say you're walking through the market and the crowd is thick and you're twisting and weaving in and out of people and a dwarf accidentally bumps into you, they automatically know something's up. So they just automatically start charging after that person. So I guess it depends on the players.
Yeah,
you're right. I mean, you don't want to get to the point that you've got no time left to get anything done because you've just described every single person in a 400-person crowd. But... I think it's important to...
Yeah.
It could be a psychological experiment. But so as you're describing each of these things, you know, you really want to make sure that you put some flavor into things so that when it's time to talk about removing a trap, that they actually, you know, have something to go on.
Yeah.
Let's run down through the list, though. How about moving silently?
There's not much role play in moving silently other than, you know, you're saying you're hiding in shadows and you're slowly creeping. And I guess you can probably get up and demonstrate it, but that'd be kind of funny.
Well, you know what? Those are two different things, but they go together. You're right. Hiding in shadows. Right.
Great example of this, actually, in my group. I had a player who was playing a thief. He was playing like a swashbuckler type thief. And he wanted to open a trap door, roll out down the trap door and into a ball and roll up and stand up and stab this guard in the back with both of his daggers. Nice. And I was like, well, that's a cool move, but that's going to be really hard to pull off. That's not everybody can do that. He's like, oh, I can do that. So I called his BS and we went into the living room.
Really?
Oh, he meant he personally could do that.
Yeah, he personally can do that. I said, if you could roll in a ball and stand up and stab after we used an ottoman, for example, for the fall length, because, you know, obviously not going to make them drop from the ceiling.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hope you didn't have any downstairs neighbors.
No, this was in my friend's house, so don't worry about neighbors. And anyway, so he dropped off the ottoman, he rolled across the living room, and he stood up and just made the motion of stabbing two pens like a sword. And I said to him, I said, all right, you got it.
That's but, awesome.
Yeah, I used role-playing instead of rolling dice for that particular thing, because he went to the trouble of doing it, which was hilarious, so why not give it to him?
That is That's very good. Cool.
I don't play with a thief acrobat in my campaign, but that's a good example of why the thief acrobat can be a cool character.
Yeah.
You know, and it's good because I actually, when I think about the thief in the game, for some reason I always flash on Ocean's 11.
Oh, wow, okay.
the remake, you know, with the acrobat and everything in there.
Yeah.
So it kind of works. But hiding in shadows and moving silently... you're right. You know, role-playing it might be not as important, but it's something that does get abused a lot. And, you know, we're talking about thieves to tell players, but I guess maybe for DMs too. It's important to remember that just because you're moving silently doesn't mean that the rest of the group is moving silently, so it doesn't
right.
really help any.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you got the paladin in full plate mail, clink, clank, clunk.
Yeah, you know. Your thief is going to have to be off on her own if she's going to move silently. Yep. And hiding in shadows is a really important one as a DM to catch people from abusing, because it only works if they didn't see you in the first place.
Right.
You're not going to be able to stand in the middle of a room, see a gnoll come charging at you and go, ah, shadow, and jump over into the shadow because they
and
just saw
disappear.
You do it. You
yeah.
don't disappear in the shadow.
Yeah, I have a 99%. I can do it. You know.
Yes. And it's also important
to
remember.
The art of not being seen.
Yes, how not to be seen. also remember that you cannot move as fast when you're doing these things either. Right. And so if anybody does have a copy of Dragon number 47, Len Lakofka put together some nice percentages in case you needed, in case you wanted exact percentages to lower a person for going faster as well. Hearing noises, that's one that it's a thief ability, but obviously anybody has some chance to hear noises. And he lays it out pretty cleanly. He just says, you know what, if you're not a thief, just go ahead and take the thief ability and cut it in half as far as hearing noises. But, you know, it's something that a thief is particularly good at because they're used to moving silently. They're also used to hearing it when somebody else is trying to do the same thing.
There's also a good
role-play
point.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's also a really good role-playing point with hearing noises because a lot of thieves wear helms or hats and things like that. You know, you got to take that off to be able to hear through a door.
Right.
And then you have to remember to put it back on.
Yep. I was also going to say, this is the point as a GM where I always have the player who's the thief, and he says, I'm going to listen at the door. And I'll say, okay, come with me. that's always my chance to pull the thief aside outside of the room, and they're like, and everybody in the party, the players are like, uh-oh, what did he hear? And what I do as a DM is with the hear noise ability, what I describe to them, and I when I have that aside moment with them, and I describe what they're hearing, you know, muffled screams or guttural type talk or what have you. I let the player go back, and I will have them describe what they hear, and I will not correct them if their description is different from mine.
Oh yeah, of course, that's the whole fun of it.
And There was a time where that happened, and it got the players into some serious trouble. So I'm just sitting there watching the guy who's playing a thief. I'm like, okay, you keep talking, saying what you thought you heard. You know, so that was a real fun moment for me as a DM. So
what's next? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So the last two, and we can kind of hit them both, is climb. Even though they're not related, I'll just give you the last two. So climbing walls, and backstabbing, two more things that you would think anybody ought to be able to do, but being a thief, you have particularly special training in these types of things.
Of targeting vital areas for backstab, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that one always kind of gave me a little bit of trouble trying to think about, well, why is a thief better at backstabbing than anybody else? It's stabbing you in the back. What's so hard about that?
They know exactly where to hit you in the back because they've been, you know, supposedly trained by other thieves that have figured out ways to kill people faster.
Mm-hmm. Right. They've learned about the anatomy of humans or humanoid creatures, and they know exactly, or they should know exactly, where they should, you know, hit you for the most optimum damage and hopeful death.
Right. And so, you know, backstabbing, I guess in that case, I'm going off of Len Lakofka's article here, but the idea is that it's not an all or nothing affair either. You know, it could just be the way he puts it is that you're only going to get total full bonus to damage if you have total surprise. But even if you're chasing after a fleeing victim, I guess, so to speak, you could still get a backstab bonus because they're not looking behind them every step. So maybe instead of a +4 bonus to hit, you've got a +3 bonus to hit or something like that.
Right.
So, you know, so the idea is go ahead and use your judgment on the backstabbing.
I've also seen players when – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying about the backstab. At least in my experience with players, they'll use that backstab ability from their thief when they have, you know, the big bad guy, you know, come into the scene or,
mm-hmm.
you know, a very a strong, tough opponent they're facing. This is where, like, the thief really is going to get into melee. He's going to try to get into that position to use his backstab ability to take down the big bad boss.
Yeah, and remember the important point there is that the thief has to actually sneak around to his backside because if it's obvious that he's trying to do that, I mean, I guess if you've got 5 PCs that are all engaging the monster, you know, yeah, there's going to be a certain point where his attention can only be in so many places at once, but I wouldn't give a full bonus for that.
All right.
And then the other one is climbing walls. Which, another one of the really potentially abused things. It's good here to know, you know, some idea of what the wall is like. You know, I know if I'm just, you know, looking over here at a brick wall where you can potentially see getting some handholds and then looking, you know, elsewhere at a sheer, perfectly smooth wall, it's obvious that unless you're a spider, you're not going to go up the sheer smooth wall. So you got to take that into account. But the other thing you got to take into account is when you're trying to climb that wall, not only are you going pretty slow, there's not really much else that you can do. Your entire attention and effort is focused on trying not to fall off of this thing that other people normally wouldn't even be able to hold on to.
So, I agree.
Yeah, mm-hmm. no checking for traps while you're going up that wall. No throwing darts and daggers at people. None of those things are going to work if you're trying to go up a wall.
And also think of it this way, in a combat situation, if they somehow were climbing a wall and combat ensues, mm-hmm. that's all to the back.
Yeah.
At least that initial attack. So there's that negative to your rear armor class.
I would pretty much make your armor class, you know, make it a 10 at that point.
I don't know I would go that far. I would just
maybe a 9 or an 8.
I would still use the rear armor class adjustment. I would probably give them a bonus to hit. But I would use the rear armor class adjustment.
Yeah, I mean, your thief's only going to be wearing leather armor. All their dexterity is going to be, forget about that. We don't care about that anymore. Right. As far as I'm concerned, their arm and the fact is they can't really, you know, do anything except drop down.
Yeah, they're all basically relying on the armor protection of that leather armor, if they're wearing any at all. So.
Yeah, I mean, think of that scene in The Princess Bride when Wesley's climbing up the cliff and just how long it takes. You know, that's a pretty good climbing walls example.
Mm-hmm. Amigo Montoya.
Oh, yeah, that is.
You get my father. Nothing.
So if do you guys watch Mythbusters?
Some every once in a while, yeah.
All right, so they did a Mythbusters episode pretty recently where they were trying out the myth of the hero who hangs by his fingertips, you know, like in Vertigo, like Jimmy Stewart. Mm-hmm. Vertigo. And they wanted to see how long can a regular person really hang there? And then they also tried it with smaller and smaller amounts of space available for you to do it. And they had professional rock climbers trying to do this sort of thing. It's a really intense thing for people to try and do, which leads a lot more credence to the idea that it's only a thief that's going to be good at it in the game, because they're the ones that have really trained for this kind of thing.
Huh.
Wow. Okay. Well, that'll wrap up the thief this week. And next week we'll talk about a different playing tip of different class. Maybe we'll tackle something different. So tell us what you think, how you play a thief, rfistaff@gmail.com, and that'll throw us into the Dragon's Horde.
The Dragon's Horde.
All right. The Dragon's Horde. This week we have the Beaker of Plentiful Potions.
Beaker.
And.
Mermaid, mermaid. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I remember that too. But yes, the Beaker of Plentiful Potions, the Dungeon Master's Guide. On page 138 for all of our wonderful listeners out there. Now, this is a very interesting item in that I'll start with how it's described here in the DMG.
Okay.
The container resembles a jug or a flask. Magical beaker with alchemical properties, which compound from 2 to 5 doses of from 2 to 5 potions of any sort as initially determined by random selection.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
And well, I mean, potion,
yeah.
It could be random. I mean, if you as the DM have something it needs to do in the game, go ahead and do it.
Well, I would randomly determine them, but I would like write them down so I would know what's in the beaker.
Right,
but
right.
I wouldn't just pick them, yeah. And the potions are layered in different layers in the container. And you roll a d4 plus 1 to find the number of potions the beaker contains. And then you roll for each potion contained so as to find out what it is. Delusion and poison are possible. And then you record the type by order of occurrence. Duplication is possible. If the container holds only 2 potions, it will dispense them one each per day, 3 times per week. 3 are contained, 1 each per day, 2 times a week, and if 4 or 5 are contained, it will pour each 4th, but 1 time per week. Once open, the beaker will gradually lose the ability to produce potions. And this reduction in ability results in the permanent loss of 1 potion type per month. So, with all that being said about the beaker, a few things I kind of jotted down about this item that left to mind was, I could see this is a very handy magical item, though there is complete randomness involved with it, because you don't know what you're going to be getting with this thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like life well, right is a off- box of chocolates, you know? You don't know what you're going to get. So
okay, Forrest.
Right off the bat, it's obvious that there's some additional magic involved in this beaker other than just the fact that it contains those potions, and that's the fact that it's able to hold them and keep them from mixing together.
Right, right.
So it's got an inherent magic to it anyway.
Right.
I've never read any other background on how this was done, but it does kind of bring into some ideas about whether or not it would still retain those magical properties after it was emptied. Could you use it for other stuff as well?
Yeah, I'd like to know a little bit more how this was this drafted up. Maybe somebody knows a little history on this.
So. Yeah, it's not really clear. I think, at least the impression I got with this magic item, once the potions are gone, it's it fizzles and the beaker, the jug or flask is no longer... Yeah, no, it doesn't explode. But that's where you get into the potion disability table.
Yeah, that's no, I think that's the way it's meant to be.
Explodes.
Right. Explodes.
But you know, as a player, I mean, I would definitely rather just have the five potions in their own things. It's a little more fun for the DM here, because if let's say that your players are able to identify the potions somehow that are in there, and they see that the one that is really important is the last one on there, and one that maybe they'd like to save for later but can't get rid of at the moment is a little bit higher up. I and they don't have anywhere to pour them to save the other ones.
True.
You could put a nice conundrum for them there.
See, I would play is they could identify the item in somehow, but there's no way for them to know what potions are inside unless they pour.
Yeah, I think it's good for the beaker to stay opaque.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I wouldn't make it, you know, yeah, I wouldn't make it see through at all. I would even if it was, you know, it's a magical item.
Yeah.
I mean, I would still make it to the fact that, yeah, this is a beaker of plentiful potions, but you have no idea what potions are in there unless you pour from that beaker into something else or drink from it. So
you could call it the beaker of desperation.
Basically, yeah. It's kind of it could be either a lifesaver or a killer, this magical item. I mean, you could get extra healing, or you can get a death, or you can get a poison. So...
Well, you know what? Let's give it a roll. I've got some dice here. So let's go ahead and put some potions
in. Okay, hold
thing.
On before you do that. Do you want to use the expanded table in an Earth Arcana or the DMG?
Let's just go with the DMG, just to keep
it. Yeah, because I know you hate the Unearthed Arcana.
No, I don't hate it. I just don't, you know, have it right at hand right now. And plus, I'm gonna be rolling a D100 on this, so let's see what we've got here. Should I use the metal dice or should I use the precision dice? I think we'll go with the metal dice just because they're more fun rolling these things up. And the first potion that we roll out of it is 57. 57 is 57? The potion of invulnerability.
Okay, there's a good start.
Good start. Do you guys have your dice or do you want me to roll for you?
You know, I don't have my dice available.
Yeah, neither do I.
Okay. All right, so let's see.
I didn't keep it in my pocket this week.
Vince, here comes your potion. You're going to take the second draft from the potion from the beaker of potions.
Yes.
And you have rolled a 19.
Oh, all right.
A potion of dragon control.
Oh, which dragon?
Oh,
it's a red dragon, as a matter of effect.
It's a D20 roll for the type of dragon.
Okay. This is a 17, so you have rolled against a gold dragon.
Nice.
So if there's a gold dragon involved, you've just got invulnerability and a potion of gold dragon control.
Ha-ha.
Ooh, me next.
Pretty good. Okay, you're next.
Yeah.
Rolling
yeah.
you up.
Nick's got the potion
got
of...
92.
The gaseous potion.
Oh!
For a moment I thought it was a potion of superheroism, but you missed that roll.
Yeah, a potion of sweet water, though.
A potion of sweet water.
That's not bad.
What is that?
That one is...
Good.
Let's see.
It just changes other liquids to pure drinkable water. Neutralizes poison. That's not bad.
Yeah, so if I was poisoned, if I had a poison, like if I got in a... We just got in a battle with, a bunch of giant spiders, and I was poisoned. Hey, hooray for me. That poison's probably neutralized.
Pretty good. Pretty good stuff. Okay, yeah, that's not too bad. And plus, it can ruin magic potions, which is always good. Nice one in case you're up against somebody who you know has a magic potion. All right, I'll give it a roll now. And I've rolled an 87. I have a potion of speed.
Whoa. Nice.
Yeah, don't do drugs.
Yeah, drugs are bad for you.
All right, here we go. We're going to give Vince...
And one more.
Vince, you're getting the last potion out of here, so...
Oh, my gosh.
Hopefully this one will do some good for the party. And I've rolled 009.
That's 09. James Bond's grandfather.
Clairvoyance.
Clairvoyance.
Ooh.
Not going to help you at the end of the fight, but it's a pretty good potion anyway. So
super.
Of course, the trouble is that as you're rolling these things in the real game, you don't know what those things are. All you know is that some silvery potion came out of the top, or something red, or something, you know, slick or thin.
You know,
I don't know.
I just thought
how
of
do
a
you
real
guys
sick,
play that?
I just yeah. thought of a real sick way of using this item. He has the potential of getting 5 magic potions out of this.
Mm-hmm.
If you have 5 containers for those things, that's potentially quite a bit of XP for a character or several characters right there.
You mean you'd give them individual XP for each potion?
Yeah, it's a magic item. It's a potion.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, if they're actually, you know, using the potion and, you know, literally getting experience with it, then yeah, they're getting experience.
Ooh, oh, yeah. Sorry. You could say, ooh, sorry, I was going to give you 1,000 experience points, but you drank it. Sorry. You drank your 1,000 away.
How do you guys go about identifying potions for the players in your games?
Spell identify.
Yeah, me too.
That's it? Nothing else? Right. So no identify spell, then it's drink it or...
Well, I mean, I also have an ability for, like, the mages in my game, the magic users and clerics, spellcraft. And if they have... And I play to where if half... They could roll half of their spellcraft ability. They could identify a magic item if they know the item's magical in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I've always let them
go ahead and just put a little on their tongue to get an idea of what it's going to do. No, I mean no. You. It sounds funny, but it's actually just that's completely by the book.
Okay.
I mean, I'll actually go back to the book here. It says that as Dungeon Master, you should add a few different sorts of... Sorry, wrong part. as a general rule, they should bear no identifying mark, so the players must sample from each container in order to determine the nature of the liquid. However, even a small taste should suffice to identify a potion in some way.
Hmm. Okay.
So, you know,
I suppose.
Anything wrong with that.
It's
one of the few places where the Dungeon Master's Guide is very kind to the players.
Yes, that's true.
For once, Gary was actually kind to people.
Yes.
Players, anyway, yes.
Well, yeah,
yes.
Players.
I'm sure he was always kind to regular people.
Oh, yeah, of course. We all know that. Come on. All
right, so there's our beaker of plentiful potions.
There's yes, very cool magic item.
That's the beaker in a nutshell. Well, whatever.
Mimi?
Yeah, that'll end this segment and tell us how you use it in your campaign. Well, guys, you know what that means.
Oh, we're wrapping up for the week.
Yes, we are.
I gotta take my books and go home.
Yes, you are no longer allowed to play. Go home.
So, a couple of things coming up for next week, just to let everybody know. Thane will be back. You know, there's more scrolls in the chest for us.
Excellent.
To take. Yeah.
I have plenty of
and
them.
I want to say thanks to people who have commented on them. I was really happy to see that when we did the All Thane and Deirdre episode or issue, sorry, when we did the All Thane issue, I was really happy to see somebody come on and comment how surprised he was that Deirdre turned out to be different than he thought. And it's nice to know that people are, and we've heard other, you know, people that enjoy this. So thanks very much because it's fun to have. So those will be back.
Oh, and quick thing related to that. Remember we were talking about doing stats for those characters?
Mm-hmm.
I think we should do that pretty soon. We should put them out there on the website. Just thinking about that. So we should maybe work on that.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I think once once there's a little more revealed about what's actually occurring. That might just be the thing to do.
Yeah, first-level character would be kind of boring right now. So
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Kind of relating to some of those other segments, I am going to start doing some more of the Blackstone's Vaults, and I'm going to continue my reviews of the S-series of modules. And I think I got I already did S1 Tomb of Horrors, so I'm hoping to do White Plume Mountain here very soon.
I'd like to see you talk a little Ravenloft on...
Oh, yeah. I plan on reviewing Ravenloft as well. Absolutely.
Cool.
I'm going to do the
That's
S series.
Cool.
And I know Vince had a request for doing Baba Yaga's Hut.
I plan on doing too.
Me?
Okay. Yeah, I plan on doing reviews of those, and
that was Jason.
We'll see what comes up in the future.
That was
Jason. Yeah, it was me. It was me, but it's okay. It's one of my favorites. But you know what? Ravenloft is one of the best modules series ever done, as obvious, you know, by how many things came out of it. So it's a great one to pick.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So that's going to wrap up the show for this week. Just a little teaser tidbit coming in May. I won't reveal too much about this, but I've gotten a lot of emails about it, and Jason and I and Nick have talked about doing it in our spare time, having a sub show doing actual play, calling it RFI Podcast Presents, and then whatever the name of it is. We do have a DM in line, but I won't say who it is just right now, just in case they still want to back out, which I don't think they will, but...
Rolling dice on the beaker.
Yeah, he's still rolling dice. I can hear him.
I'm getting more potions.
So when that happens, we'll let you know, and we're starting to record in May. So, we're going to head off for tonight. This is Vince signing off for the RFI staff. Keep it original, keep it old school, and good night, everybody.
Night, everyone.
I'm going to get more potions, damn it.
Roll for initiative.